underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In 1989, fresh from the publication of his first novel, The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, Michael Chabon traveled to his mother's home in Oakland, California, to visit his terminally ill grandfather. He was on heavy painkillers, and his mind wandered. Chabon's grandfather shared recollections and told stories the younger man had never heard before, uncovering bits and pieces of a history long buried and forgotten. That dreamlike week of revelations forms the basis for Chabon's new novel, Moonglow, which unfolds as the deathbed confession of a man the narrator refers to only as my grandfather. The grandson can finally see his grandfather as a young man who was an unheralded hero of the OSS in World War II, an engineer who dreamed of the stars, a pool hustler, a lover, and an unabashed felon. Again, the name of the new novel is Moonglow, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Michael Chabon to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thank you, John. Happy to be here again.
1989, when you traveled to your mother's home. Mm-hmm. So at what point did you think, oh, this could be something that I could use for a novel?
At no point did I think that. I did not decide to use that framework of my experience sitting at my actual non-fictional grandfather's bedside until I had begun to write the book itself, which it did begin as a story that I'd heard from my grandfather, although it was a story that not one of the stories I heard that week when I was visiting with him. It was one of the ones I had heard before. It was one of the ones I'd heard a couple of times over the years about a brother of my grandfather's, one of his brothers, who had been fired from his job working actually at a company that sold commercial paper products, office supplies, so that Alger Hiss could be put on the payroll after Alger Hiss got out of prison and nobody would really give him a job. So this uncle of mine, this great uncle, lost his job to Alger Hiss. I don't even know exactly why, but I started to work with that story and retell it, and I made the decision to have it be about my grandfather, not my uncle. And once I made that fictionalizing decision, I was off to the races writing this novel and very quickly hit upon the idea of using that moment when I sat with my grandfather when he was talking and his tongue was very much loosened by medication and I was hearing things I'd never heard before. That's the point at which I thought, oh, I can use that.
What happened to your actual grandfather?
He died after a few months after we all became aware that he had cancer. It was very fast. He lived till about the age of 74, and he lived long enough to have seen my first book published, and he was a very big booster of mine. And he sent me this card to congratulate me on his publication that I still have. That was a photo of the Empire State Building's needle with the Goodyear blimp approaching it. And Mysteries of Pittsburgh has a reference to the dirigible of August tied up and bobbing in the high winds at the top of the Empire State Building. So it showed me not only that he read the book and thought about it, but then he spotted this card in the shop and it reminded him of the book. You know, he got to see the fruit in a sense of all the stories that he had ever told me. And he, unlike the grandfather in my book, who's a very taciturn man, mm-hmm. who rarely speaks, and when he does speak, he tries to have his words matter. My grandfather was very loquacious. He was very verbal. He loved wordplay. He loved just joking around, and he loved to read, and he loved to talk. He was not so stern as the grandfather in this book, but still things came out that I had not heard before, and that impressed me. And what it mostly impressed me with was this idea of, like, what else is in there that I'm not hearing? You know, all this stuff I'm hearing for the first time has been just sitting there. I don't think he's thought of this stuff in 50, 60 years, some of it. So what am I missing? And I was right at that age where you are old enough. I was 24, 25, where you're finally old enough to appreciate your grandparents as human beings, as real people with feet of clay or real lives and struggles. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, in my case, and I think for a lot of people, that is exactly the moment when you start to lose that generation too, and it was almost too late for me at that point. But it did make this strong impression, like, this man is a man, not just my grandpa. It seems so obvious, but it seems to take people a strangely long time to get there.
I think it's inevitable in reading the novel to wonder that intersection of fiction and memoir. You set the tone right off in the author's note, mm-hmm. which I'm hoping you will read, and then we'll go from there about this theme that you set up.
Sure. This is the author's note. I hasten to mention that the author's note occurs on the what I would call the sort of the novel side of the half title page. So everything after the half title page, in my mind, is part of the novel, including this author's note. In preparing this memoir, I have stuck to facts, except when facts refused to conform with memory, narrative purpose, or the truth, as I prefer to understand it. Wherever liberties have been taken with names, dates, places, events, and conversations, or with the identifications, motivations, and interrelationships of family members and historical personages, the reader is assured that they have been taken with due abandon.
Did you start with that, or did you write that later?
No, I wrote that later. I wrote that along the way when I, I made this choice. I'm going to do this in the form of a fictional memoir. That should be useful, helpful. It made the characters feel much more real to me, much more readily in my approaching them as my grandfather, my grandmother, my mother, referring to them that way. Just, I got more of a sense of immediacy. But at a certain point, halfway through the first draft or so, I just, I started to really think, well, what are the implications of this? And what do I want the reader to know about this book? I'm not trying to trick anyone. I'm not trying to pass this off as my actual memoir. And I don't want to be deceptive in that way. But I also don't want to just give the whole game away either, or just, like, I am, ultimately this book is about the truth as it emerges in families, that strange process of consensus and imposition of narratives over other narratives and willful forgetting and accidental omission. And it's a process that arrives at often at a good story, but a story that may actually not bear a whole lot of relation to what actually happened. And even if you sat two people who were present for the event and asked them to give their most faithful account of it, a pair of brothers, some siblings, or, parent, child, ask them to talk about something that happened 30, 40, 50 years ago, or even a year ago, you're going to get very different accounts. And when you have siblings, you get in these conversations where you start remembering something that happened, and then suddenly somebody says, "Dad wasn't there." Like, yes, he was. I remember he was there. No, he was not there. He was in Chicago. And like, no, he, so I wanted that doubt and that uncertainty and that sense that there's a kind of a mythologizing process at work to be, without wanting to deceive anyone, I decided to sort of be open about the fact that this is a deception, which in a way is what all novels do anyway. There's an mm-hmm. implicit contract between the reader and the writer that this is all made up. It's fiction. I'm lying to you. Would you like me to lie to you? And the reader says, yes, please lie to me. I have come here to be lied to. And then in the process of this collective exchange between the reader and the writer, you arrive at a kind of truth, at a truth that in some ways you could not have arrived at simply by reporting on facts in the case, if there are any.
So that idea of a speculation on history, but a personal history in this case.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to, in a sense, invent a history for a family that, while in most respects is not like my family, bears some resemblance to my family or the history of my family. When I was talking about my grandfather and when he died, and feeling like I didn't really know this man. Like, I loved him. He loved me. We were very close. He was, a really good grandfather, but I didn't know him. I didn't know him as a man. I didn't know anything about what he had struggled with in his life. Why he wouldn't have shared that with me as a child. It wouldn't have been appropriate, and I probably wouldn't have wanted to hear it either. Then, I lost him. You lose that generation, and you've lost your opportunity to ask now, and frequently, especially now that I'm 53, now I have more questions than ever.
Sure.
And none of the people I could ask are around or have it been around for decades in some cases. So it sort of almost falls on me then to try to imagine answers to the questions that I would have about my family and what happened in my family and why people did the things they did and acted the way they acted. I had to, in a sense, invent a history for my family that really doesn't bear a whole lot of relation to my actual family at all.
It is the strangest thing when you realize that the people that you always went to for the answers of those questions mm-hmm. are no longer with you.
Yeah, it's frustrating too.
And you say, well, I should have listened more. Mm-hmm. I should have written this
Why
down.
Why didn't I ask? Why didn't
I know this?
Like, oh, I remember them talking about this or that, but I didn't pay attention really, or I didn't realize that was my one shot, and I blew it. And I know I've been giving an example. I've talked about this photograph that I came on pretty recently, within the past few years, of my actual grandmother, my mother's mother, who was a very quiet, unassuming woman, nothing like the grandmother in this mm-hmm. book. Very just lived her life very quietly and did all the things that a good suburban Jewish housewife for the 40s and 50s and 60s was supposed to do. To be totally honest, she never made that strong of an impression on me as a kid. She was my grandma. She cooked well, hugged me when I saw her. I mean, she gave me presents on my birthday. I didn't have a sense of her at all, much less than I do to my grandfather. And then I found this picture very recently of my grandmother about the age of 18 or 19 in the streets of Philadelphia. Looks like an ordinary day, and her hair is cut Amelia Earhart short, like a boy's haircut, and she's wearing knickers and knee socks and a big bulky sweater. She's dressed like a boy of the time, like the way a young man would dress. And she has short hair, and she has this kind of like rascally smile on her face. And, you know, I looked at this picture, I'm like, who was that woman? And where did she go by the time I met her? And was this just an anomaly? Was this just the day she got her hair cut? And so they thought, oh, that'd be fun to dress you up like a boy. Or was this how she dressed all the time? And I have no one to ask. There's no, like, my mother didn't know the answer to that. And there's nobody left who could answer that question for me. So it's this mystery. And that sense of mystery, the enigma of these people that you descend from, who are as close to you almost as you can possibly be to anyone, that they could be such riddles. So much about them remains utterly unknown forever, even to the people who were in a position to know them best. That's sort of ultimately what the theme of this book is.
If you had used their actual names, then that would take away that mystery, wouldn't it?
Well, and also it would have felt too untrue to me as the writer. I mean, to create the history for the grandmother in this book and have her have my actual grandmother's name just would have been bizarre. It would have felt weird. It would be like writing a novel about someone named Sherlock Holmes who's, you know, an elevator operator in a Las Vegas casino and has no powers of detection whatsoever. It just would seem wrong. And I don't even necessarily mean morally wrong. So I couldn't name them for that reason with their actual names. But to make up names for them, to invent fictional names for them, also felt wrong to me, because in spite of the fact that these characters and this portrait of a family is so heavily fictional, and I'm not just saying that because people always say things, oh no, it's all fiction. Right. It's not a generic disclaimer. It's really true. However, on some level, they also, as soon as I took any step to try to, that would have effectively distanced me from them as my grandparents and my mother and my father by giving them fictitious names, for example, or I contemplated briefly, I started to acquire some photographs of a generic Jewish family on the East Coast in exactly the same period as would have been for my family. I had enough of them that I could have sort of created this photographic section in the book that would have purported to be pictures. And that felt off too, like looking at these people, even though I'm not writing about my real grandparents, to look at actual wrong faces and say, this is my grandmother, this is my grandfather, that didn't feel right either. I was definitely in some strange nether world between reality and fiction the whole time I was writing this book, where it really did feel true to me. It felt like it really happened, even though I knew perfectly well I was making it all up.
In our discussion, you've used the word game and you've used the word riddle.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see it that way? Do you look at it as the creation of a puzzle in some way that you want us to try to solve?
I don't know if I ultimately want the reader to solve it so much. I think it is more like a game than a puzzle. And I mean, I think writer and reader are always playing a game with each other. And I love to read books in which that sense of the game being afoot is evident. You know what I mean? Maybe the most obvious great book that does that is Pale Fire by Vladimir Nabokov. And it's a book that, you know, readers have will probably never finally settle on a consensus about who wrote the prologue and who wrote the poem and is it this character's version of that character or the other way around. And I enjoy that experience as a reader. And that was definitely a part of what I hoped would happen. Because one of the sort of most rudimentary games that I think readers play with writers is while you're reading a novel, you know, you read it and it's set in, let's say, Albany, and there's a character that it says is the main character is married to a physician. And then, you know, you look at the author's note and it says the author lives in Albany and his wife is a physician. And so you start thinking, oh, I wonder how much of this is true.
Sure.
And you're always sort of comparing the author photo to description of the character or things you've heard about the writer and comparing it to what's in the novel. I do it. I think most readers do it. It's inevitable. And so as the writer, knowing that readers are going to be doing that, I decided almost just feed that as a kind of like misdirection, the way a stage magician, you know, knowing which way people are most likely to look when something's happening on stage, that's where he puts the distraction so that the magician can actually pull off the illusion while they're looking over that way. And so that's sort of why I feed the reader a steady stream of these references that sound like I'm probably talking about having written The Mysteries of Pittsburgh or having written Cavalier and Clay, or, you know, and I make references to things that I know are known parts of my biography or my bibliography in a way to sort of occupy the reader's attention with that stuff that I know they're always on the lookout for anyway.
We have mentioned the grandfather. Let us talk about the grandmother for a moment, because this is a fascinating character who really is just larger than life and has a mental illness, mm-hmm. and there is a lot going on there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, she's a damaged person. She has been through some experience during the Second World War. There are at least two versions of what that experience was that are presented in the book. She's a very unstable personality, and I don't mean by that simply mentally unstable. There's a fluidity to her character. There's a fluidity to her personality that the people around her, her husband and her grandson primarily are the people we see experiencing this, her daughter as well. It's something very seductive about her at the same time that it's frightening. So that, you know, the grandson early on has this thing he tells us about how this game that his grandmother played with him when he was a little boy, where she would bounce him on her knee. And she had this rhyme in French that she would say about riding a horse. And she would be bouncing him on her knee. And when she got to the end of the rhyme, usually she just hugged him. But every so often, she would part her legs so that she didn't have a lap anymore, and the little boy would fall through to the floor. Mm-hmm. And he never knew. And so he tells us, like, while she would do this rhyme, he would watch her face the whole time trying to figure out whether she planned to dump him or hug him. And it's that unpredictability that makes her a challenge to live with, you know, in addition to whatever torment she's suffering from her mental illness. It makes her a challenge to live with, but also makes her exciting to live with. And there's something deeply appealing and kind of romantic about her at the same time that there's something frightening and devastating.
Very early in the novel, in one of the early chapters, as you're introducing the grandmother, you include a list. You know, the five things that mm-hmm. I know about my...
Right, that's one of them. My five earliest memories, yeah.
Now, that could have been something you could have just incorporated into the story, mm-hmm. but you wanted that list.
Right. Well, lists are a feature of this book, and they are primarily used as a feature of to convey the grandfather's personality. The grandfather is an engineer.
Yes.
He's a very methodical man. He's very interested in failure analysis and in avoiding cliches, avoiding emotional language, avoiding things that muddy the situation. He always wants things to be sort of as neat and precise as possible. And so I imagine he was my initial list maker in this story, and I used lists a few times in the course of writing his story. I found myself resorting to lists just as a, it was not even a choice. It just felt natural to him that he would think this way. And then I decided to incorporate a couple of more of these lists, but from the point of view of the grandson, to sort of show that he has inherited in some way, or that he has been influenced by by his grandfather, that he has a certain amount of this as well. Or maybe it's only in the kind of tip of the hat, you know, like a tribute to his grandfather's list making, that the grandson also makes a couple of lists in the course of the book.
Well, and also that these are the things I understand. These are kind of the baselines,
right,
if you will.
You're trying to like keep it clear and sort of focus on what it is you know and ignore all the things that you don't know.
The idea of moon glow and model rocketry and all of that, how did that come into the story?
Well, the title actually was one of the very first things that came to me. I had only been working on the book for a couple of days, and I realized I was working in this period that's primarily set in the middle part of the 20th century. And I tend to listen to music while I'm writing, and often that music can be programmatically related to what I'm writing about. And I remembered how when I was writing The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, I listened to a lot of big band swing and just swing music generally from that period. And my favorite thing to work to had been Benny Goodman trios and quartets. And so I put that on just to kind of get me in the mood for writing this section, this opening section of the book I was working on. And that tune Moonglow came on, that Benny Goodman's version of the song Moonglow. I had a sense just immediately, like the way this song sounds, I should say the way that I feel when I hear the song is the way that I want readers to feel when they read the book. It's this sort of poignant, soft, melodic, wistful, but also with this melancholy and a hint of darkness, and a kind of, it has a lost quality to it. It's partly a function of the recording technology of the time, but it just created this immediate mood in me, a sense of the past in this sort of slightly distant but affecting kind of sense of the past. And I just thought, okay, I'm just going to call this book Moonglow. I don't even know why, but I'm just going to call it Moonglow. And then once I had that as the title, the moon just worked its way in all these different ways, including through the Apollo program and moon landings. And I was also very quickly aware I was going to try to tell the story of Chabon Scientific Company, this real-life going commercial concern that sold model rockets in the back of magazines in the 1950s and early 60s. And so the moon and rockets, it all just seemed to go together. So much about this book just fell into place so quickly, stuff that I didn't even know yet how I was going to use it. I knew I was going to need it later on. I don't even really quite know why.
So I will end with this question, which is, does this novel seem more personal to you, or do all your novels seem personal to you?
No, this one seems more personal to me, and not so much because it is a memoir, even a fake memoir, that is unquestionably rooted to some degree in real family history and real things I observed or remember about various members of my family, not just my grandparents, but their siblings and that whole generation in my family, but because it ends up being in some ways that I did not expect and I did not intend, kind of a self-portrait, and not a self-portrait in the obvious figure of the narrator who bears so much of a resemblance to me in so many ways as in the grandfather. The grandfather, in many ways, is the kind of person I would be if I let myself. I think I have the potential to be as taciturn, as antisocial, as dismissive of human foolishness and frailty, as possibly even, I would say, as violent as a grandfather is, because he is a violent man subject to fits of anger. And that is all in me for sure. I'm not sure where I got it, probably not from my actual grandfather, but there was a kind of a sense of, you know, by removing a couple of key pins here and there, if you remember that old game Kerplunk where you would pull out the pickup sticks, and if you pulled out one too many, all the marbles would drop down. I just pulled that one pickup stick, and I was able to be the character of the grandfather quite easily. I found it very easy to do. So the book ends up being a strange kind of speculative self-portrait.
Michael Chabon's new novel is Moonglow. It is published by Harper. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Oh, thank you, Joe. I enjoyed it.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Special thanks to Paul Ruest and Argo Studios in Manhattan. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.